Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, May 5th. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from CHP Berkshires, celebrating 50 years of health care, family support, WIC, and food security, serving nearly 30,000 Berkshire residents, primary care, women's health, dental, and more. CHPBerkshires.org. Joining us today is Dr. Alexis DiSilvestro of St. Peter's Maternal Fetal Medicine, a practice of St. Peter's Health Partners. May is Preeclampsia Awareness Month. Today we'll talk about what preeclampsia is, risk factors, symptoms, and treatment. Dr. DiSilvestro is also here for your general OBGYN questions. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Alexis DiSilvestro and your calls coming up. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Here on this edition of Medical Monday is Dr. Alexis DiSilvestro. She practices maternal fetal medicine, helping to care for high-risk pregnancies. Her professional interests include prediction and prevention of preterm birth, fetal diagnosis, hypertensive disorders of pregnancy, fetal growth restriction, and multifetal gestations. Dr. DiSilvestro received her medical degree from Penn State College of Medicine in Hershey, Pennsylvania. She completed a residency in obstetrics and gynecology and a fellowship in maternal fetal medicine at Penn State Hershey Medical Center. If you have a question, give us a shout. 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Feel free to email if you're shy and retiring. voxpop@wamc.org is the email address. Dr. Alexis DiSilvestro, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
Been a couple of years now, right?
Yep.
Well, okay, May is Preeclampsia Awareness Month. Why do we need an awareness month for this?
So preeclampsia is a major cause of maternal and neonatal perinatal morbidity or complications. It affects 5 to 8% of all pregnancies, and it is one of the top three causes of maternal mortality across the world, accounting for about 15% of directly pregnancy-related maternal deaths. It'll affect 10 million women in the world this year alone, and it is the leading cause of medically indicated preterm birth.
What is it?
Yeah, so preeclampsia is a high blood pressure condition in pregnancy. It is the new onset of elevated blood pressure with a systolic or top number blood pressure greater than 140 millimeters of mercury and a diastolic or bottom number greater than 90, usually after 20 weeks. Some other picky criteria for how much they repeat and how far apart those repeated pressures are. It's often associated with protein in the urine and can lead to other end organ dysfunction, so like liver injury, kidney injury, even lead to things like risk of stroke or seizure in pregnancy.
You know, some people have high blood pressure and they take medications for it. Are there symptoms that just a normal person can see without putting a pressure cuff on 24/7?
There are symptoms for preeclampsia, but not every person who ultimately has those elevated blood pressures will develop symptoms. Symptoms, of course, could be the most common ones we talk about, the severe ones, would be a persistent headache, especially one that doesn't respond to typical treatment.
Let me stop you there.
Yeah.
A lot of times in pregnancy, women will have migraines or headaches visual migraines.
Yeah.
How are you going to separate that?
So there's a few things. Obviously, a careful history. You know, if this is new for a patient who doesn't have a history of headache, doesn't have a history of migraine, I always tell patients I would rather have them call or come in hundreds of times to make sure that headache is just normal headache, not associated with increased blood pressure, rather than, dismiss that concern. So usually they need to be seen. They need to be evaluated if they're having those symptoms.
You know, there was a time when I was concerned that I might be having cardiac issues, and I bought a cuff. Should all pregnant first-time moms have a cuff?
So I think you're hitting like some of the really high-interest topics that we talk about with preeclampsia.
Really?
Yes, like in the first...
Let me tell you, that's dumb luck. Let's just keep rolling with it.
Yeah, so actually there's a lot of discussion about home blood pressure monitoring. I think there's debate, but I think absolutely patients with risk factors should have a home blood pressure cuff. I don't think it hurts anybody. You know, overall, since there's an incidence of 5 to 7%, most people are not going to get preeclampsia. But I think that because a lot of people will have elevated pressures and can be completely asymptomatic from those, if they're educated in how to use the cuff, it can potentially be beneficial. And certainly for patients with risk factors, I think it's worthwhile. And I educate them about how to do home blood pressure monitoring, and also the importance of bringing that cuff with them to make sure it's functioning properly, because a lot of the automatic ones can be a little glitchy.
Yes. Well, it turned out I'm the picture of health, so I didn't even need mine. The number here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We're joined by Dr. Alexis DeSilvestro of St. Peter's Maternal Fetal Medicine. You know, one thing about dads, and once they've had been the father of a couple of children, and they think they know everything. So every time they see a pregnant woman, they say, oh, you got to get your feet up. Get your feet up. You got to rest. You got to get. When preeclampsia is a thing, it does affect the feet and ankles, right?
So, yes, but not only preeclampsia. So absolutely, a lot of patients will come in and want to be evaluated or have concern about their lower extremity swelling because of the association with potential preeclampsia. And certainly, you know, preeclampsia is associated with what we call intravascular volume depletion, which is basically a fancy way of saying, like, their blood, they're dehydrated in their bloodstream, but that fluid has gone into what we call the third spaces, like the ankles. They're swelling. It's out in their soft tissue. But that can happen in pregnancy as well. So yes, that can be associated, but it is not like a unique finding to preeclampsia.
Well, assuming you get it, if you are someone who in a first-time pregnancy mm-hmm. has preeclampsia, a couple questions. We'll get back to what do you do to treat that patient in a moment. But if that person then goes on to have more children, mm-hmm. are they at risk? Are they going to get it every time?
They're not going to get it every time, but they do have significant increased risk. So we talk about different risk factors for preeclampsia. There are what are like high risk factors and moderate risk factors, and a history of prior preeclampsia is a high risk factor. So depending on how severe their preeclampsia was the first time around and other factors like that, that affects the rate of recurrence, but they definitely have an increased risk compared to someone without that history.
Mm. All right, what do you do? If assuming that there's not morbidity in childbirth mm-hmm. and the baby's okay, mom makes it through, what do you do?
Well, so when we diagnose preeclampsia, it depends on gestational age, what we do, and then what we do postpartum. But basically, preeclampsia is cured, or I'm using air quotes, which listeners can't see, but the cure process starts with delivery. However, when we diagnose it, we don't necessarily immediately deliver. It depends on how severely affected they are. Basically, the only reason we keep patients pregnant is for fetal or neonatal benefit for baby. If it were just for mom, we would deliver her immediately. So we're basically weighing those ongoing maternal risks of continued pregnancy with a potential benefit for baby for staying pregnant. So, you know, depending on the severity of disease, we may recommend delivery immediately. That also, you know, if they have severe features, By 34 weeks or at diagnosis, sometimes earlier if they're really, really sick.
Otherwise, that's about 7 months?
Yeah.
My math is not
very good. If we do like a 10-month gestation, but I could get really nerdy with it. But yeah, and then 37 weeks, or about 3 weeks before the due date. So early term for patients who aren't really severely affected. But it's not an immediate cure. So that's the fun thing, that it can continue to have ongoing effects. So they need close follow-up postpartum as part of their treatment as well.
What do you do? Now, I knew a woman who gave birth and was unknown at the time, until basically the day of the birth, that she had preeclampsia. Mm-hmm. And they kept her in an extra day. They had her in a magnesium drip. Mm-hmm. What does that do?
So magnesium is used to help predict the risk of recurrent eclamptic seizures. So preeclampsia is called preeclampsia because it can lead to eclampsia. So we have these preliminary things like the hypertension, maybe protein in the urine, and eclampsia is the addition of grand mal seizures to that clinical picture.
But you can get preeclampsia and not have a seizure, right?
Correct. You can get preeclampsia. Not everybody's going to progress to get full eclampsia, but it's all kind of under the same spectrum of hypertensive disorders in pregnancy. And so magnesium has been shown to decrease the risk of recurrent eclamptic epileptic seizures in those with increased risk. And so increased risk basically means people with the severe features who have, you know, neurologic symptoms like the headache, crazy blood pressures, things like that. So usually patients are given that for about throughout their labor and delivery course and about 24 hours postpartum if that is, you know, kind of the time of onset.
Let's take a quick break here. Dr. Alexis DiSilvestro joins us today from St. Peter's Maternal Fetal Medicine. And May is preeclampsia month, but we can tackle other topics as well. The number is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. We'll be back. On a Joe Pass kick lately. There's Joy Spring, which was a great Clifford Brown tune. Joe Pass, great guitar player. It's a Medical Monday, not a musical show. Dr. Alexis DiSilvestro joins us today from St. Peter's. And let's see here. This email from CC. A friend recently had a flare-up of Epstein-Barr syndrome at the very beginning of her pregnancy. Her symptoms soon resolved, but then she was found to have a non-viable pregnancy. Are these two things related? And if so, what can be done to prevent this in the future? And that's from CC.
Okay. So certainly maternal infections of various types can be associated with fetal loss. And depending on the condition, you know, there's a lot of things that may not be ultimately preventable. So things that can flare, like viruses that can be recurrent, they're higher risk to have adverse effects on the pregnancy and on the fetus if they are a primary infection and not a flare-up, not a recurrence. It doesn't mean it obviously doesn't happen. And in timing of those things also would weigh heavily on how likely it is to have that kind of an adverse outcome. So certainly there is not a lot, unfortunately, with any infectious condition that at least a viral condition like that, that we have great prevention or great treatment methods for, great ways to prevent adverse fetal outcome, primary prevention of acquiring that infection, which unfortunately, you know, is quite difficult through the course of an adult life.
Yeah. No, you know, you've studied this, you've gone through all the fellowships and residencies and everything else. Does it sometimes amaze you that the human race even survived?
I'm always amazed, even with just what I do. First, yeah, absolutely, that we've all survived this long. For me, that, you know, although doing what I do, I see a lot of complicated pregnancies. I see a lot of fetal anomalies, babies born with, you know, serious conditions. I'm amazed how many times things do go well.
It's incredible.
Right,
I mean, think
right.
about even 100 years yeah. ago, and then think about 1,000 years ago.
Right, right.
It's incredible.
Right.
It just goes to show you women are so much stronger and smarter and better at everything. This is from Margaret. If a pregnant woman tests positive for group B strep before delivery, how quickly should they go to the hospital after the water breaks? Do you always treat with antibiotics for maternal group B strep?
Yes. So we always treat if a mom is group B strep positive. And for those maybe who don't know, group B strep is a bacteria that is not necessarily harmful. It lives on about 40% of people at any time in the perineum. And it can change like from one pregnancy to the other. So we universally screen every pregnant patient for group B strep. And the reason is because it can pass to the baby at delivery, and it can cause a pretty catastrophic life-threatening infection. Fortunately, it's very rare that babies get GBS sepsis, but when they do, it can be fatal. So we universally screen, and if somebody is positive, then we would absolutely give antibiotics. Penicillin is usually the antibiotic of choice in the absence of allergy. And yes, if your water breaks, I would suggest you go straight to the hospital because you want to get started on your treatment, but also you could go into labor.
Okay, so always. You know, this is another thing. You know, dads think they know it all, but child number three, we're at a steakhouse and the water breaks. And I'm like, oh my God, we got to go. And my wife said, you know, just let's finish the steak. How fast do you have to get in?
So it depends. We don't know how quick any individual person's labor will progress. I'm like a cautious person, and so I always am like, if you don't want to have your baby at the steakhouse, you should probably get going.
We probably would have got a free steak.
Right. But, you know, certainly people, especially people who've had babies before, may be more likely to have a quicker delivery. So I would urge them, if their water breaks, you know, start getting your stuff together and get going. But some people can have prolonged, you know, rupture of membranes. They could break their water and not progress spontaneously in labor. Some people may have spontaneous labor, but just kind of not be moving that quickly. And so it's very variable.
Most every time water broke in the dozens and dozens of children we've had, it didn't follow quickly afterwards.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, they sat around and
said,
okay, yeah, you go home, do whatever you got to do. Number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Alexis DeSilvestro joins us today. And let's go to Latham. Christy, you're on.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
Hi, I just have a quick, well, kind of a statement and a question. I heard that it was preeclampsia month, and I just wanted to make a statement about how important it is also, even though it's more rare, for postpartum preeclampsia. And I was going to ask the doctor, you know, how rare is that complication? I mean, I suffered from it. I had a 5-day onset after a C-section, ended up back in the hospital for 3 weeks on magnesium sulfate.
Wow.
So, I don't know, just as a person who had that happen to her, mm-hmm. I know there's preeclampsia, there's a lot of awareness for preeclampsia, but I don't think there's as much talk about postpartum preeclampsia and how dangerous that can also be.
Yeah, no, that is a great point. I'm glad you called with that, you know, statement, concern, question. We definitely see it. And I think that you're absolutely right. It's really important to have awareness about postpartum. That's part of why I alluded earlier with the air quotes to the cure for preeclampsia being delivery, because it is not 100% of the time that delivery patients do show up sometimes with postpartum preeclampsia, even postpartum eclampsia. I've had patients come in having seized at home. And that is part of why some of the changes that like ACOG, the American College of OBGYNs, is kind of making changes to guidelines for how we provide postpartum care. You know, we always talk about the 6-week postpartum visit. You have a delivery, you go home, see in 6 weeks. And that's not really adequate for a lot of things, but preeclampsia as well, because it can happen. And I don't know if you had any risk factors beforehand or not, but it happens plenty of times in patients who don't. They have their delivery, they go home, and all of a sudden they're back. Yeah.
So that's, all my prenatal checkups were great. And it was, I had a C-section, and I told the doctor, I'm so swollen, I can't, and I was swollen up to my waist. Oh, you'll be fine. It's just fluid. You had a C-section.
Yeah.
And then my best friend is a labor and delivery nurse, and she brought me back to Berkshire Medical Center when I was in Pittsfield at the time. And thank God she brought me back to the hospital when she did. And then I know you have other callers, but I just have one more quick question. Is it true that, like, if you suffer from, you know, preeclampsia or postpartum preeclampsia, you have a 50% risk each pregnancy of having that happen again?
Depend-
it goes down if you're with the same partner?
Yeah, those are great points. You do actually have an increased risk, depending on the severity, would probably modify the percentage, but absolutely increased risk to have it again, as high as 50%, sometimes even greater. And yes, interestingly enough, this is me getting really nerdy. If it's the same partner, there is a component of like paternal antigens that contribute.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, fair enough.
Well, Chris, I was just curious about that, yes, but thank you very much for taking my call. I enjoy the show greatly, so
Christy,
I'm glad I got to.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it. 800-348-2551 if you have a question for Dr. Alexis DeSilvestro today. 800-348-2551 or email voxpop@wamc.org. So are some women more predisposed to getting this? And what are those factors that you say, okay, well, this is a likely candidate?
Absolutely. So yes, there are people who have like baseline increased risk compared to others. So some of the risk factors include nulliparity, which just means first pregnancy, never had a delivery before. Patients who already have hypertension, you know, we talked a bit, you mentioned hypertension, high blood pressure earlier, patients with chronic hypertension, patients with like elevated BMI, obesity, BMI over 40, I always say people who are old like me, advanced maternal age patients, patients with pre-existing diabetes, autoimmune conditions like lupus, especially if they have lupus nephritis, multifetal gestations, so IVF pregnancies, whole bunch of things.
What are the things you don't know about preeclampsia?
So much.
Okay. Well, I have time.
Yeah. So, well, we think that it is caused – in part by the way the placenta develops. And so there's hypotheses about the way these little blood vessels within the placenta and the uterus and the connection there called spiral arterioles develop. They found that in placentas of patients with preeclampsia, they had like blunted, short, stubby spiral arterioles.
Really?
Yeah. which is real nerdy, really microscopic.
Yeah.
But we know certain things that can like affect that. But we don't necessarily know a whole lot of why otherwise. Like, we think that that is part of it, but we don't know why, why those things happen. We just know how maybe we can modify that potentially.
The guest today is Dr. Alexis DeSilvestro. She practices maternal fetal medicine and knows a few things about OBGYN, too. If you have a question, the number is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. All right, you ready to take a trip down to Pennsylvania?
Sure.
Okay. Jim and Matamoros, you're on.
I may have already covered it, but I was wondering about low magnesium levels in the blood as being the cause.
Yeah, so we haven't had any research to confirm that like a low magnesium level would be associated with a cause for preeclampsia. Certainly, overall electrolyte abnormalities are important. Magnesium primarily has just been studied with regard to treatment. It hasn't shown any benefit for like prevention. No vitamins or supplements that we found have been helpful.
So if you dose up on magnesium while you're pregnant, it's not necessarily going to do anything.
No, you'll just probably have great bowel movements.
Ah, splendid. Well, Jim, thanks for that, and thanks for bringing that up, Doc. 800-348-2551 is our number. No, what does the magnesium do when a patient has had the child and is on a magnesium drip? What happens? What does it do?
Yeah, it's supposed to act on certain receptors that are affected by like the neuroexcitability that we see with preeclampsia. But it's not the only thing that can do that. There are other anti-seizure medications that some patients can use because magnesium can have some other negative effects. Preeclampsia itself is associated with risk of pulmonary edema, but magnesium, especially increased magnesium, may be associated with pulmonary edema.
Well, just so that this radio guy knows, what's pulmonary edema?
Fluid on the lungs.
Ah.
Yeah.
All right, very good. The number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Alexis DeSilvestro joins us from St. Peter's Health Partners, don't you know? In the introduction, it mentioned that one of your interests is prediction and prevention of preterm birth. How on earth are you going to make that prediction?
Well, there actually are some useful tools. Obviously, historical factors contribute to prediction. So for patients who've had prior preterm birth, that's the number one risk factor for preterm birth in any subsequent pregnancy. But also, like, cervical length is a tool for prediction of preterm birth. Short cervix, even without symptoms, between certain gestational ages has been associated with increased likelihood of preterm delivery. It's not great for, like, determining when, like, how preterm. But just that if it is below a certain threshold, that's associated with higher risk of preterm delivery.
Interesting.
Primarily in singleton pregnancies, not as well studied in multifetal pregnancies. Or certain medical risk factors or like growth abnormalities may be associated with higher risk or uterine anomalies.
You mean growth abnormalities of the fetus?
Yes.
Not of the mom.
Correct.
Interesting. So when we talk about prevention of this, what do you do?
So we are, I'm laughing because.
Because I'm asking ridiculous questions?
No, not at all. Because women's health can be a bit ridiculous at times. Because we used to have a lot more things we could try to do. Historically, through my training and early part of my career, we could use progesterone to try to decrease the likelihood of recurrent preterm birth. It was approved for use in women with a prior spontaneous preterm birth. But that has since gone away. Follow-up studies showed maybe there's not a benefit. And so the FDA approval's gone away. The guidelines recommending it have gone away. And I say it's sort of the wild, wild west of preterm birth prevention.
Hang on. Why did it go away?
So originally, there was a study done in 2003 that was basically the best kind of study we can do in medicine, a double-blind, placebo-controlled trial of injection progesterone compared to a placebo for women with a prior spontaneous preterm birth. And they actually stopped that study early because there was such a great benefit in the progesterone group. They said, this is unethical to continue the placebo. And from that point on, they got early FDA approval and rolled out treatment with intramuscular progesterone or an injection progesterone. But they needed a follow-up study study to retain that approval. The follow-up study released, I believe, in 2018, it was published, actually showed no benefit. And so after a lot of back and forth, it has been taken away. It is not available anymore. It is no longer recommended. And now we don't do injection progesterone. Some patients are candidates for vaginal for specific indications. But because we don't know if it works or not.
Are you
still
okay with that? In other words, one was a very strong outcome.
Yeah.
And it was ended early because ethically you didn't want to expose people to a placebo when it worked so well. And then and I could ask you why. I could geek out and say, what was different about study two?
Yes.
Was it a different group of people? Was it from a different country?
Absolutely.
Was it a smaller group? What happened?
I feel like you have been doing homework because this is like just landing.
Really?
Yes.
I better go play the lottery. Let me tell you something.
So yeah, actually, so that was part of the debate, and I think that's why it took so long from when that second study came out to when things actually went down with the FDA. The original study was done through the MFMU, like a big consortium of maternal fetal medicine units, academic centers here in the United States. The second study was done, 60% of patients were from Ukraine and Russia. Minority of patients from the U.S. There were also discrepancies. So there were racial and ethnic discrepancies, nationality discrepancies, BMI discrepancies, discrepancies in like how early their qualifying preterm birth was, meaning like how early the prior preterm birth was that the patient had that made them eligible.
What kind of study is that?
So it's hard to compare, but they found that. So basically, the short version is the second group, the second study was probably lower risk patients, but they still showed absolutely no difference between the two, which is why it's gone.
Doesn't that strike you as odd?
It strikes me as odd. And ultimately, what I think, and this is why I say it's the wild, wild west of progesterone right now, because it doesn't, those patients don't necessarily represent our patients, but we are in this question mark phase of there needs to be more research, and then it's hard to get that research done. So there are patients right now who they are not on intramuscular progesterone. That's difficult to come by now, but some patients with a really prior, really early prior preterm birth may be on vaginal progesterone, even though it's not technically recommended because they have an extreme enough prior history that we are giving them this medication, which granted has a, like it was, it's FDA, approval was not taken away because of any danger. It was taken away because of lack of benefit. So it's not really associated with a lot of risk. And that's why some people will still use it if you have a particularly high risk patient.
Interesting. But I mean, okay, how long ago were these studies? I'm sorry to, I have to know. How long, was it a long time ago or was it recently? And why hasn't there been another one? It seems like the third time would be the tiebreaker.
Well, don't get me started on research in women's health.
Oh,
I mean, I was saying earlier to Courtney, right now there's some issues with funding for things are getting flagged with certain words in them. But, don't get me started on that.
All right, I promise.
But also, you know, it is hard to do women's health research. It's hard sometimes to recruit, and it's hard to get funding. Patients aren't always interested in participating in something randomized when, like, a pregnancy is on the line. You know, they don't necessarily want the chance of getting the placebo.
Yeah.
So it's hard to do. And, like, the money part, unfortunately, like, the money part's always the big issue.
The number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Alexis DiSilvestro practices maternal fetal medicine, and she is here to answer your questions from St. Peter's Health Partners, don't you know? The number is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. This email from John in Stockbridge. My maternal grandmother and her husband had blood types that produced 3 miscarriages. Why does this happen? Also, now my son, 38 years old, and his wife, 29 years old, have the same issue. She has already miscarried once. Can anything be done about this condition?
So, absolutely. Well, I guess it's a bit of a complicated question, you know, without the details.
Right.
But certainly, especially when we're talking about like grandparents' age, I would imagine that some of that may be related to Rh incompatibility if it's a blood type issue. Nowadays, Rh incompatibility is a much less of a problem than it used to be because of the advent of Rh immunoglobulin, or Rogam is the brand name that a lot of people might be familiar with. That is an injection that's given to pregnant patients who are Rh negative to try to decrease the likelihood of what we call alloimmunization, which is basically mom making antibodies against her baby's blood type.
Oh, that's really bad.
Yeah. It used to be a big cause of fetal death, basically. It usually didn't affect first pregnancy, but any subsequent pregnancy could be affected.
Can I stop you there?
Yeah, sure.
Because, you know, I'm not that bright. But wouldn't the baby have the same blood type as the mom?
So blood type's actually really complicated. There are the simple, like, A, B, and O system that we think about when people know their blood type. They usually say one of those letters. But then there are all sorts of other antigens or markers on those cells beyond the A, B, and O categories we talk about.
Yeah.
The most common one that we worry about is the Rh, which, funnily enough, like, that actual antigen is big D. So it's called the rhesus factor, but it's a D. So if you have antibodies, you have anti-big D antibody.
Okay.
And there's all sorts. It's like alphabet soup, basically, when you talk about the antigens on the red blood cell. But that's the biggest risk one. And you can have an Rh negative mom and Rh positive dad produce an Rh positive baby that could be attacked by moms. Whereas the A, B, and O antibodies are like too big to cross the placenta, so they're usually not a problem prenatally.
Is this akin to like an organ rejection?
Sort of, yeah.
By the way, we have to take a break, but I have never seen any living person get so excited about blood types as Dr. Alexis DeSilvestro. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551 is our number. WAMC is our website. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. We'll be back. Surrey down to a Stone Soul picnic. There's Aqua Velvet here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551. Don't laugh. I used to be a DJ back in the old days. It still calls to me. Our guest today is Dr. Alexis DeSilvestro from St. Peter's Health Partners. And you wanted to finish up on the last question from John in Stockbridge.
Yeah, because alluded to what we call recurrent pregnancy loss, so early pregnancy loss in the first trimester. And there are lots of reasons that can happen. And sometimes it's just repeated dumb luck and there's not a lot we can do to prevent it. But it is one of the things that's like really difficult to deal with because it's hard for patients. And there are a few things that we can evaluate for patients who are going through that. So certainly, you know, if there's history of like blood type issues or other antibody issues, certain acquired, what we call acquired coagulopathy, where patients get antibodies over time that can increase their risk for things like blood clots or pregnancy loss,
yeah,
or even things like parental chromosome abnormalities.
Okay.
So
number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Alexis DeSilvestro joins us. Let's go back to our phone lines. 800-348-2551. Matthew is in Ulster County. Matthew, where are you in Ulster County?
In the Cronkton area.
Okay, you're on the air. Go ahead there, sir.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was just calling because we have a child in our life who was born with severe IUGR. He had no other underlying issues. He was born in the first percentile, so it was severe IUGR. But no doctors or pediatricians have really been able to speak to me about what sort of long-term outcomes to expect for a child like that?
Yeah, that's a very good question.
You're going to tell us what
yes,
it is?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Yes, for those who don't know, IUGR stands for intrauterine growth restriction, or we also say fetal growth restriction, but severe growth restriction, one of the things that I would say is the long-term outcomes associated with it would also depend on, you know, gestational age at delivery and how the neonatal course goes. But in general, you know, growth restriction is also can be a misnomer. Even when a baby is really teeny tiny at the first percentile, we don't know how big any individual baby was meant to be. So that's always one thing I reiterate to patients and parents in general. But we do see some interesting things with small babies. You know, some babies with severe growth restriction may go on to remain petite through much of their life. But we also see the opposite. We see potential increased risk for metabolic disorder. So things like obesity, diabetes, hypertension later in life. There may be some neurodevelopmental effects, but all of them, they're really hard to quantify because we see an association, but not necessarily a causation.
So we don't know why the growth is restricted? It's not a physical size of the mom?
There are risk factors for growth restriction. So it can be, you know, I think of them, and ACOG kind of lumps them into maternal, fetal, and placental causes. And fetal causes, I'm going to start with the middle. Those may be things, those are things that are more inherent to baby. So we might see genetic conditions, structural abnormalities. Those are generally associated with earlier onset of the growth restriction. And those particularly may be the ones that might have higher risk, especially because it's not environmental, it's the baby themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's maternal conditions like, you know, pre-existing hypertension, poor maternal weight gain, or maternal malnutrition, but it would have to be pretty severe to truly be causative, maternal autoimmune condition, substance use, or placental. And placental kind of ends up being a catch-all. It can be actual structural abnormalities of cord and placenta, but it can also be what we call placental insufficiency, which is a fancy way of saying the placenta is just not working well enough.
Mm. Matthew, did you want to follow up?
No, that was all very helpful.
Right, well, thank you very much. Now, you mentioned, I don't know if I wrote it down correctly, poor maternal weight gain?
Yes.
Is there a metric that you say, well, mom, you have to gain this much of your body mass?
Yeah, so there are gestational weight gain goals depending on any pregnant patient's pre-pregnancy BMI, which obviously is an imperfect
This is
assessment,
for the mom I'm talking about.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so say, you know, you just have air quotes, normal BMI patient who comes in, pre-pregnancy BMI of 24 or whatever, she can gain 25 to 30 pounds or so in pregnancy, and that's the recommended amount. Everybody should gain weight, even patients who have a BMI over 35 or 40.
Why is it important?
So what's interesting is, you know, you're growing a baby, you're growing a human, basically. That is a major metabolic undertaking. And as I tell my patients, it sounds funny, but basically babies act like parasites. They are going to take what they need, even if it's, you know, depleting mom's nutrients, depleting her all sucking calcium from her bones, all the things. So I say,
why do you say that with such glee? That's it's terrifying.
Because because most of the time people think of pregnancy as such a happy time, and it is for most people, but it is also a major undertaking for the mom. It is a big physiologic burden, worthwhile, but it is a big undertaking. And so I like to remind them, like, that is why we want you to gain weight. But even if you're not, I tell them, don't sweat it. Don't perseverate on your weight day to day. Don't stress out. If you're eating adequately, don't panic if you're not meeting those weight gain goals, because I'm not trying to have people have like an eating disorder in pregnancy. I want to make sure your baby's gaining weight. So if you are outside of those weight gain goals, well, you may be doing some extra imaging just to make sure baby is gaining. But other than that, like, there are parameters for risk assessment, not necessarily goals mom has to stick to if she's struggling, if she's not gaining weight.
So interesting. I never knew that. Dr. Alexis DiSilvestro joins us from St. Peter's Health Partners. And these metrics were developed how? In other words, okay, mom, you're 127 pounds. You have to gain 40 pounds.
Yeah. No, there are... oh my gosh, I'm forgetting which of the organization, but there are various World Health Organization has some. ACOG obviously stands by some of them. I think some are not U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, but another of those. But I always say, like, the smarty pants who get together and evaluate all the research that's been gathered and summarize it for the rest of us.
Interesting. you mentioned progesterone and sort of the odd diametrically opposed studies and some of the controversy about that. Are there any controversies in your line of work, in your specialty, that are still to be decided?
Yes. I mean, everything, right? No, I think maternal fetal medicine specifically is interesting because, you know, there's obstetrics and gynecology. There are certain things for which we have guidelines, which change from time to time with evolving research and new information.
Yeah.
But with what we do, I think sometimes we are where you go to when there's not a consensus. Like, if you're not sure what to do, an obstetrician will send their patient to see us to make a recommendation. So the Society for Maternal Fetal Medicine is our governing body. They have some recommendations that they give above and beyond maybe an ACOG clinical statement.
Yeah.
But otherwise, we are where you go to when there is still debate.
Okay, well, you didn't give me any specific answers, so I'm not gonna, this is not 60 Minutes. I'm not going to press you on it. The number here is 800-348-2551. If you'd like to press Dr. Alexis DeSilvestro on any particular question, the email is voxpop@wamc.org. Fetal diagnosis is an interesting thing. I mean, we've all seen the, well, most of us have seen the ultrasounds, and they're amazing. But what other things can you get that are not invasive? What other information that can you get that is not so invasive as to harm the fetus?
Well, even the things that we would say are invasive are generally not harmful and have very low risk overall. But I will say first, the completely non-invasive things, you know, I think we talked a little bit about non-invasive prenatal screening last time, the blood testing for screening for aneuploidy or chromosome abnormalities. So things like Down syndrome, trisomy 18, trisomy 13.
And
so
how are you drawing that blood?
Just maternal blood draw. Like,
oh, it's from the mom.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So you don't have to.
Correct. So basically, all of us, you know, usually this is the same spiel I give my patients. Our DNA usually lives inside our cells on our chromosomes. But when our cells get old and die, they burst, they spit out their content, including that DNA, floats around for a little while in your blood until it degrades and goes away. But the cool thing is when you're pregnant, that also happens into the maternal bloodstream with cells from the placenta. Yeah. So this test takes advantage of that. But it's assuming that the baby and the placenta have the same DNA, among a couple other assumptions.
The number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Alexis DeSilvestro joins us. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Joanne in Westmere writes in, when I gave blood, I was told that I have CMV negative blood, which is good for babies to get. Would you explain more about this?
Yeah. So CMV actually kind of circles back to some of what we alluded to with
viral infections.
Are you
getting excited about blood types again? Because I'm going to leave.
A little
bit. All right, go ahead.
So CMV is cytomegalovirus. Cytomegalovirus, interestingly enough, is in the herpes virus family. And why that's important is it lives in us after we've had it. So basically, you have had it once. It lives in you forever, dormant. It doesn't cause lesions like HSV 1 or 2. It doesn't cause sores. When we get it, we feel like we have a cold at most.
Oh, okay.
But it is the most common congenital infection, meaning an infection baby is born with due to maternal infection. And it is important if we are going to give blood to, you know, neonates, people without that immunity, they'll use it like transplant patients and stuff. CMV negative blood is super important because if you already have, you want to make sure there are certain things that aren't present in blood that you're giving to someone if it's going to have like a dormant virus in it.
Right.
Right. And also there are certain like strict criteria for like really sick neonates, even fetuses get transfusions. So yeah, CMV negative.
How do you do that?
Well, I don't.
Okay,
but how does
one do it?
Yeah, so that's something called PUBS or percutaneous umbilical blood sampling, and then generally followed by transfusion after that sampling. It's done at specific centers. It's been very regionalized to high volume centers. Actually circles back to antibodies in the blood. The reason we don't need it as much and the reason it had to be so concentrated is because of Rogam. PUBS is not as common as it used to be because most babies don't need transfusion anymore. It's a lot rarer. But basically, it's an amniocentesis type of procedure. They put a needle in mom's abdomen through the uterus under ultrasound guidance into the cord to sample babies.
Into the umbilical cord.
Yep. They want to see how anemic baby is, basically. And then based on that, they do some calculations and give very specific types of blood back into baby's cord to relieve that anemia.
Joanne had CMV negative blood. Is that very, very rare?
I don't know that I would say it's very, very rare. I wouldn't know within like the blood donor population what it might be because I don't think we universally screen or test outside of blood donors. We don't even universally screen in pregnancy because there's not necessarily an intervention. We only test patients who have certain risk factors and if we have certain concerns along the way.
All right. Well, you can in these waning moments, by the way, if you want to call, go ahead. You can give me a basic seventh grade level description of how a baby gets the nutrients. In other words, mom eats, and then how does the baby get what it needs?
Yeah, so it's basically all the placenta. So Basically, you know, baby lives inside a sac of amniotic fluid. Most people know about the sac because that's what breaks.
Right.
And then attached to the sac and growing off of that sac is what's called the placenta.
Yeah.
The placenta basically is an organ that is connected to baby by umbilical cord and to mom through microscopic projections, basically, and chunky projections called cotyledons. And basically, it invades into mom's uterus, preferably, hopefully, just the right amount to not detach during pregnancy.
So it's like alien, is what you're
saying. Yeah, kind of.
Wow.
And basically, so mom's blood will pump to those connections, and the nutrients will kind of pass by the normal like cell transport mechanism, some passive, to baby's blood and carry it back to baby, and then baby's waste will come through the umbilical arteries to the placenta and be passed out back out to mom to get
rid
of.
What if that waste doesn't necessarily pass through?
Well, so most of the time, that's usually not the problem. The problem may be things coming the other way.
What do you mean?
So we can get babies, it's kind of, it leads to that placental insufficiency, resistance in the placenta. I guess they kind of relate. If you have a very resistant placenta, babies having to pump really hard to get blood to that placenta, we see that sometimes in growth restriction. What we're looking at there is what we call umbilical artery Dopplers. And we're measuring the blood flow in baby's cord from baby to placenta. But it's not really, even though baby's having to work hard to get the blood there, it's the perfusion of the things baby needs to come back to baby that tends to be the bigger issue.
Okay. You know, listen, we know the old wives' tales. Oh, so-and-so, required pickles and ice cream or whatever. Every mom has a craving, and I've seen this. It happens, not necessarily pickles and ice cream, but yeah. Why? Why? Dr. Alexis DeSilvestro, you have 1 minute. Go.
Oh, I wish I knew. I do think it's very interesting because it's definitely unique, even within the same pregnant patient, to her unique pregnancy. You know, from one baby to the next, she might have different cravings. I think
does it have a biological reason for the child, for the baby?
I think that some may. People who crave ice and crunchy things, that can be associated with, like, iron deficiency.
Oh.
Or people who will even eat non-food things, they will crave non-food things. That's called pica. And that can be associated with iron deficiency. So certainly some of those things may be related, but some of them we still don't exactly know. There may be a reason, but we haven't figured it out yet.
Are you still as amazed as most of us lay people about the miracle of childbirth?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, isn't it an incredible thing?
It is.
And I'll circle back to the beginning. I can't believe the human race is still here. You are a person who is focused on a very specific subset of specialties. Mm-hmm. And there are many like you. And yet, back in the cave, 6,000 years ago, people were sprouting out, you know?
Right. I mean, we did have a lot higher maternal and neonatal mortality back then.
Yeah.
But still, some managed to survive, and here we are.
Well, I guess we're about done. If people want to find out more about the maternal medicine program at St. Peter's, how do they do that?
Do
you even know, or should we ask? Should we ask the flack in the corner?
Yeah.
Oh, just put your mic on, Courtney. Jesus creepers. No.
I was gonna say they can go to our website. Is it SPHP? .com. You can find us there.
What does she do? Shouldn't she prep you before the show?
Our office. I can say where our office is. We see patients at 400 Patroon Creek, Suite 108.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Lovely new office there.
Well, this was fun.
Thank you. I learned
a lot of things. Dr. Alexis DeSilvestro, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you.
We're
for
just about
me.
Out of time. Listen, thanks to everybody who called in. Thanks to Zachary Malloy, Bob Rathbun, who was on vacation. He came back just for this show. Superb job, sir. Support comes from Daughters of Sarah, Albany, New York, providing a continuum of care for seniors, offering them opportunities to live and age gracefully with dignity and respect. Daughtersofsarah.org. Once again, thanks to Dr. Alexis DeSilvestro for joining us. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Zachary Malloy, our engineer, delivered another program today. Good job. Thank you. This is exciting. Tomorrow, it's Birding with Rich Guthrie and Julie Hart. Rich has celebrated 30 years on the air at WAMC, and he's still as vital and exciting as ever. I'll prove it tomorrow at 2. We'll see you then.